Let's return to This Week in America. Here's your host, Rick Bratton.
What if the life you built suddenly fell apart? For Dr. Janelle Louise Olet, that's exactly what happened. She went from running a high-pressure career in the culinary world to facing financial collapse, a painful divorce, and a serious health crisis all at once. But instead of staying down, she did something remarkable. She stripped everything back, her lifestyle, her mindset, even her relationship with food, and rebuilt her life from the ground up, starting with what was right in front of her, the land, the kitchen, and herself. In her book, Between Farm and Fork, Journey to Find a True Path, she shares a powerful story of resilience, reinvention, and rediscovering your true purpose. Dr. Olet is a chef, scientist, educator, and advocate for sustainable agriculture. Currently serving as Director of Agriculture for Planted, her work bridges the gap between food, healing, and personal transformation, helping others reconnect with what truly matters. If you've ever felt stuck, burned out, unsure of what comes next, the conversation is going to hit home. We welcome Dr. Janelle Louise Olet to This Week in America. Doctor, a pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to have a conversation.
This is an important book, and I'm looking forward to it as well. So much to talk about. And your book weaves together food, farming, personal reinvention. What connects those worlds for you?
Well, that's really, I guess, in my mind, food is the sole source of our ability to stay alive, right? Food and water
Yes.
are essential. But they're also essential for the whole planet to function properly. When we link in the farming, making the food for us, it also is plant material for other organisms as well. And having soil, both allowing those things to feed us and other organisms, it also cleans the water that we and other organisms drink. And so I like to think of all of it as a giant system that in thinking about ourselves in one single system, and that you could broaden that out to the earth, being that if we caretake ourselves and the planet with equal mindset, I think we would all be better and feel better, and the world would be a better place.
To get through what all you went through, you talk about a toolbox that you used, and a toolbox you say we all have. How can someone recognize the tools they already have? For most of us, I'm sure, we don't even realize that toolbox exists.
I truly think that that's often the case, is that we don't realize that we already possess often what we need. I think we have them. We just haven't learned necessarily to use them and to lean on them. And tools are things that are maybe an intangible thing,
yes.
Something like courage, or confidence, or the ability to have humbleness in a situation. All of those things are things that we learn through experience. Sometimes we're fortunate enough to have learned them in our childhood. And sometimes, such as myself, you learn them through kind of really screwing up and trying to rebuild yourself. And it's like reaching down deep inside you to pull out that tool when you need it. And often fear, I believe, holds us back from doing that. It's so much easier to just wallow in our self-pity and sit there and go, well, that happened. I don't know what to do next. But if we really take the courage and we even ask for help, that help can help us learn how to use those tools that are in the toolbox and get ourselves back out on our feet and move forward. Because sitting and wallowing in your self-pity is okay. As I tell my kids, you can do it, cry in your pillow for half an hour, then dry the tears, take some reflection, and determine how you're going to pick yourself up and move forward, because really there is no other option.
That's interesting. So sort of sometimes we feel like we have to totally suppress it. You're saying just take a little time, let it go, and then suppress it and go about fixing things.
I think when we process it, like we let it go,
yes,
we don't have to suppress it anymore. It becomes fuel to move forward. Because denying our feelings and emotions is absolutely not the way to go about it. It leads to a lot of kind of physical harm, really, and stress, and that's just bad. But I think it's like taking the time to let that emotion process it, feel it. It's okay to feel it. Life will whack you upside the head sometimes, and it's okay to understand that pain is things that are inevitable. It's really the suffering that's optional. And it was Haruki Murakami who said that. And I truly believe it's like, you know, pain is something that's going to happen. You can't avoid it. However, you can certainly avoid the long-term pain by learning how to heal from that and moving forward.
Our guest is Dr. Janelle Louise Oletz. That's O-H-L-E-T-Z, important because her website is oletzgrow.com. All of this on our website and great information there. And we'll talk about what all's available at the website as we go through our conversation. The book is Between Farm and Fork. And you talk about recovering from trauma and also letting go of doubts and fears. And I mentioned that because you mentioned fear before. How big a factor is it in dealing with doubts and fears? And how do we, does that hold most of us back?
I believe it can hold a lot of us back for sure. It's like fear of failure, fear of what people think. You know, we often make decisions on not just what we want, but, oh gosh, I don't know. How will I appear? It's like, you know, I do Instagram. I have an Instagram, and, you know, even myself, I think about, I'll do a video and like, oh, that'll look stupid. Right. That's really fear in a different outfit, essentially, right? Holding you back from potentially moving forward for success. So I think often that is fear comes in many, many different forms. That self-doubt of, oh, I'll look stupid. Oh, I don't know how to do that. What if I make a mistake? What if that's not the right path for me? Often, you know, young individuals, they get to college and they're painted a really rough picture in school. It's like, you know, it's a straight line. You're going to go get a degree and everything's going to be hunky dory. And those that are past maybe 30 realize that that's a line of baloney, is that it's not straight. And the career you think you're going to do is likely not the one you're going to stay in. But then when you're unhappy, let's say you spend all this time and you become a lawyer, you know, like you've got all that schooling and everything, but you're doing law and you really find you hate it. Do you stay with it? Because that just seems like a really rough way to go. Or do you find a way to use those skills in a different manner that would still reach back to the reason why you became a lawyer in the first place? Maybe it was really just to help people. And so maybe you could do something tangential to it that's not really the exact same thing as just going to a firm and practicing law. It's like, what, essentially back to the toolbox, what tools do you have that you can use in a different way to find a different path that maybe fits better with the authentic person that you are?
And the concept of stripping things back that I mentioned in the beginning, in that case, you strip things back, you figure out where you are, where you'd like to go, what you think you could do. Our guest is Dr. Janelle Louise Oletz. We're talking about Between Farm and Fork. So much on to discuss in the program. Book available, by the way, wherever books are sold. Audiobook available as well. Talk about dealing with fears and doubts. You bared your greatest missteps and failings in writing the book. What was the hardest truth that you had to face while writing this memoir?
I would say my divorces. There's two of them. So, you know, I have children by both relationships. And so it was walking a fine line to ensure that I was being true to the events that happened, not sugarcoating things or only blaming the other party, but at the same time being respectful to my children, as they are adults now, and them reading the book as well, that I was honest, but not the oh poor me. So I wanted to ensure that it was somewhat ambiguous so I could protect the parties that didn't have a say in being written about. But at the same time, really owning up to my part in the mistakes and missteps in my life. And it took a lot of editing back and forth to get that right. I'm generally protected by nature, and the editor was like, "Give us more, give us more." And I'm like, "Yes, however, it's not a book. It's a memoir, but it's a book really meant to help others. It's not a book about, look at me, oh, poor me. It is a guidebook to ensure that someone that's reading it can see themselves in my journey and see that they too could move themselves forward."
You have a number of five-star reviews, and they almost all, if not all, are five-star reviews. And I think a big part of that is the relatability. They can see what you're going through, the honesty. Maybe they have to face that honesty factor as well before they tackle what's going on in their lives. And I want to talk about maybe where this started, this personality that you have. You grew up on a rural farm in New Hampshire, subsistence farm. How did that shape your success and who you are, and this great attachment connection you have with the land, and how that plays into how you went through this difficult period and survived?
Well, my dad, who was generally part of my trauma, but also part of my strength. And he really, there was just that, well, the stubborn streak, perhaps I come by that naturally through both my parents, in that you just don't give up, you keep moving forward. So the connection to the land, I would say, came from my mother. In that, when we were growing our food in the garden, she would talk about the health of the soil and how you have to put organic matter back to it and you have to take it, how that makes for healthier plants and how that made for healthier food. She was reading Rodale Press back in the 60s when it first started. I
Oh,
mean, my
yes.
parents are kind of like the back to the landers. And so that was really baked into everything we did, but it was. Also, I mean, my dad's business went bankrupt. We were extremely poor. We relied on hand-me-down clothes from the people that my dad worked with, which certainly led to being made fun of at school, but I guess it gives you a thicker skin. But it was that learning to lean on others slightly, but never asking for a hand out, just asking for help, and that the land can give you that independence and that support if you caretake it in a way that ensures that it can support you and support others, because we did sell our vegetables and we sold the hay that we raised on the farm as well. It all went to help support us, essentially. So, we supported ourselves with the food that we grew and grew enough of it to have an extra source of income, which led to my mother having a little bit of independence.
What did that teach you about work ethic? You used to milk cows by hand. I know I never grew up on a farm, but had friends who did. And boy, this was like a almost a 24-hour a day job, especially during the planting season. What did this teach you about work ethic? Because nothing comes easy, does it?
No, correct. It's like that whole adage of like you put your head down and you keep moving. That's really what it is. It's I guess I because I didn't have a choice, I learned it by being told you're going to do this and didn't have an option. But I also learned that it's not as bad as your mind wants to make you think it is. You can just keep focusing on the job at hand and continue to work at it and get it done. And if you work efficiently, and that's one of the things my dad always taught us, was how to do something a little bit quicker. Where can you determine where you're wasting time, and don't waste time. Don't dawdle, as my dad would say. Pick those feet up. Which, as a kid, you're dragging your feet because you don't really want to go milk the cow at 5 in the morning before school.
Yes.
But it's just the reality of the situation. It is one of the things that we can give up an awful lot of things that are, I don't know, a waste of time in my book. I mean, everyone has choices on how they want to spend their time. But when someone will say, oh, how do you do everything you do? Because I still make my own bread. I make my own yogurt. I have a garden. And I work a 40-hour plus work week as director of agriculture, as well as I wrote this book in 16 weeks and then edited it in another 16 weeks. And they're all like, how do you do it? It's like, well, I don't watch television, for one. I don't spend an awful lot of time surfing the internet. I think if we really take a accounting of where we spend our time, it is a choice on whether we spend it where we can have an outcome of a productivity or reaching a goal, or we could just kind of let it be wasted.
Yes.
And, you know, so I think that's where my work ethic is often just, I am very goal oriented and I see a goal, I'm going to reach it. I'm going to just continue to focus on each day kind of chipping away at it. I mean, it's like, you know, Da Vinci or some of these other artists, Michelangelo, you know, when you get a block of marble and he's making a statue of David, he didn't do it all in one day. He did it a little at a time.
A key word you had there is accounting. And I think when people complain about lack of time, if they went back, and I know in my case, and accounted, it's like, you know, did I really need to spend 6 hours going through the internet checking news sites yesterday? Because everything changes today anyway. So what good did it do me? The world's the same way as it was yesterday. Wasted time, and you sort of learn from that. You've experienced mm-hmm. professional highs and personal setbacks. What did you learn from failure that success could not teach you? Did you learn it? Obviously you did. How can we learn from failure and build from that and use that as an opportunity, a springboard to start over?
Well, certainly when you fail, you learn what not to do.
Exactly. Yes.
First and foremost, but it's important to ensure that you learn the lesson. Obviously I was married twice and divorced twice. So that I had to fail twice to finally figure out, all right, there might be something to this that I need to figure out why I'm attracted to this certain type of personality. And maybe that's not the best for me. And should I learn to work on myself first? Then at business failure, you learn to either decide, well, work for someone instead of having your own business, or you learn where were the mistakes. You definitely have to look back and see where were your missteps. So you and get guidance where you maybe have a learning gap. And I think, you know, it's like when we learn to walk. I have never seen a child yet who has just walked and never fallen. They take a couple of steps and they learn a little bit more about balance and how to use those muscles. So I think failure is just like that. You kind of need to make mistakes. And when we have this mentality, this fixed mindset mentality, that if we don't get it right the first time, we're just not good at it, that's like self-defeating. We have to know that it's very likely we aren't going to get it right the first time.
Our guest on the program is Dr. Janelle Louise Oletz, OHLETZ. Her website is oletzgrow.com. Information available there on the book, and you can link on directly to Dr. Oletz's website by going to our website, thisweekinamerica.us. The book is Between Farm and Fork, Journey to Find a True Path. You built a successful career in the culinary world. On the outside, it looked like everything was working for you. Was there a moment that you realized it was all starting to fall apart and I really need to redefine my path? Was there a moment when that really dawned on you, this isn't working, I need to go in a different direction?
Well, actually, it was because I had to sell the bed and breakfast. I mean, if I hadn't had to sell that because of my divorce, I would have still been doing it to this day. I enjoyed doing that. It was... one benefit, though, was that I was where I lived was also where I worked. But when I would become a chef somewhere else, it would have led to me working 80 hours a week and not being home with my kids. And they begged me to not go get a job as a chef outside of the house.
Yes.
So I had to find something else to do that fit with what my skill set was, but then that's what led me to go back to school and pursue the sustainable agriculture and food systems because it was very much in line with what I was already doing with sustainable food. And from there, I kind of continued on with school and got my master's and then the PhD in soil science. So it was really just following the breadcrumb trails that were being presented to me through the various opportunities and continuing to still stay connected to that love of land and health and taking care of ourselves and taking care of the planet.
It's a remarkable story and inspiring story. It's between Farm and Fork, book available wherever books are sold, an audiobook available as well. Information at doctor's website, drolettsgrow.com. Many people in midlife feel stuck. They're left behind. What would you say to someone who feels they've missed the moment? And we've all known people, maybe even ourselves, that have thought, it's probably too late for me to go back and redefine and to start over. Is it ever too late?
No. I actually, when I was getting my master's degree, there was a woman who had retired, and she was in her 60s and working on her PhD, and then received her PhD, you know, she was like 67 or something like that, and then continued to work in the science and the research, because that's what she was following what was she was passionate about. Now, I didn't go back to school until I was in my 40s, and I achieved my PhD a few months before my 50th birthday. And so I truly think that at any age, you can pursue something if either your passions have changed or you finally discovered the thing that really you are passionate about and want to make a life change.
Food plays an important role in your story and in your book. How can returning to the kitchen become an act of healing? How did that work for you? That this was sort of back to the foundation, back to your basics, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. And food is health. And when we get back in the kitchen and stay away from the drive-through, I think we will do all of ourselves a favor. And I am, you know, that's one of the things that I'm working on, that to create a program on mindful eating and mindful meals mastery, essentially a way to get people to feel more confident and comfortable within the kitchen in both healing their relationship to cooking, to food, and to healing and regenerating their own self. Because when we feed ourselves with healthy food, we will save an awful lot of money in the long run on our health care costs for sure. But I think it's just even just taking the act of cooking something and being mindful as you're chopping the vegetables and not seeing it as a slog, but seeing it as a way to be truly connected to how you are caretaking yourself and your family.
You can find out about this program at the doctor's website at oletsgrow.com, Mindful Meals Mastery. You can sign up there, get weekly newsletters. There's even a test, I love this, to determine your cooking skill. If you feel like, okay, I'm pretty much a microwave type of person, I don't have many cooking skills, you can help us through that by this test, can't you? You can guide us in the direction that we need to follow.
Right, because you can't determine where you need to go if you don't know where you're starting, for sure. And so, you know, anyone can learn how to cook. I think often when I used to teach the cooking classes and at my bed and breakfast, you know, lots of people were like, oh, if I don't have an ingredient, I just don't make a recipe. It's like, well, you know, you can make it up as you go along. You can kind of change something. That's kind of like that fear of failure. Also, again, getting in the way.
Yes.
Right. But my daughter and I, we actually have our own podcast. My middle daughter's a chef as well, and she's a private chef. And the two of us in our podcast, it's Two Mini Cooks in the Kitchen, TWO. And for that, like at the end, we end every episode with a little bit of a little recipe challenge. So we pick a food item, and each of us has ahead of time given our recipe to the other one. And so we each make each other's recipes and critique. The like, well, if I made this, I would have done this, or this is what I changed in that, even though we've told each other we're not supposed to change or adapt the recipe, but we do every single time because that's just what chefs do. And I think that playfulness, I want more people to feel like being in the kitchen isn't a punishment. It can be pleasure. But I am the first to note that on at the end of a tough day, it's nice to have leftovers in your fridge as well.
That comes in handy. You wouldn't have leftovers if you hadn't have done them in the first place. So there's a benefit for that cooking. A word you use in talking about that, I mean, in fact, a lot of aspects of our lives is overwhelm. When we start thinking, maybe I need to shift a little bit to healthier foods. And then you pick up a paper, you go online, you look, and there are 12 articles, some conflicting, about what you should be eating, not be eating, do this, do that. You get overwhelmed with information. You try to cut through that, don't you, at your website, at the program, to make it easy and get over the overwhelm.
Right, because it's like stop the deer in the headlights. Exactly, because I think it is far too overwhelming. There's so much information, a lot of it being misinformation. It's like any tiny little step that you can make in moving towards a major goal. You're not going to get there right away, but don't focus on perfection. Just focus on the little bit of practices that you can integrate in. I think it's like take one step at a time. And the recipes that I present in this program, which is not available yet, but will be, is easy, simple, foundational steps that you, once you learn those foundational practices, you can then begin to just cook anything. But you have to start from learning the difference between what does saute and what is braise and the different techniques. I mean, it's actually the way culinary school works is you spend a whole class learning how to chop stuff. I mean, a whole semester just cutting onions and cutting carrots and doing it over and over again until you master the knife skills. And once you've mastered the knife skills, then you move on to the next step.
Interesting. Our guest is Dr. Janelle Louise Oletz. I'm learning something as we go along here. I should be taking notes on this as well. The book is Between Farm and Fork. Her website is oletzgrow.com. A blog she has there as well. And I'm touching on this for a second. A Building a Better You, How Small Habits Can Lead to Big Changes. And again, you talk about the overwhelming. And we all want to get, we know where we'd like to be. And we'd like to do it before tomorrow, if it's at all possible. And you're talking about the small steps. That's really important, isn't it, in everything in life, is sort of break it down in what's doable and then accomplish that and go on to the next step.
Exactly. You need the overarching goal, but then you need to break it down into the micro steps, because then you'll feel a sense of progression and success. So each time you can kind of check another little thing off of that. Yes, I did that, and celebrate that. That's super important, because it's that positive biofeedback that continues to encourage you to keep going. It's like, you know, if you're going to hike Mount Everest, you don't start at Mount Everest. You start at, like, well, you got to start at the bottom, but you first would have to do a little bit of training prior to that. You have to do something on a little bit of a smaller thing. I mean, the first time you hike, I mean, you know, you want to maybe do an hour. You don't want to go out on an 8-hour hiking, because it's a lot, and you're probably not going to make it all the way to the top, and then you're going to hate it and you're never going to do it again. Start small, I think, is a good way to build the muscles that you need to do the whole goal.
So much at the doctor's website, oletzgrow.com. You talk about discovering your true calling, healing the land through regenerative practices. Talk about that, because for most people that just go to the store and buy the food, we have no idea what you're talking about. The soil's there. The ground has always been there. It's always going to be there. I go get my food. There's never a problem. Talk about why that's so important and why that became really a calling for what you do in your life.
Yes, the soil and the soil health, we've been degrading our soils since we have been using kind of more conventional farm practices, where we till the soil and we manipulate the soil. We use herbicides, we use pesticides. Soil is a living thing. It has microorganisms in it, flora and fauna, that actually help to recycle the nutrients and make them available for the plants that and things that we eat that come from that soil. So even if you eat beef, that cow had to have eaten the grass that was grown in that soil. So if you have degraded soil, It has lower amounts of nutrients. So there's lower amounts of nutrients for the animal or ourselves that eat that. And it passes through. So the regeneration is really bringing back the health to the soil. And that then brings back the health to the ecosystem and the health to all of what is grown on that by creating more nutrient dense food available. But soil does more than just support the growing of food. It helps to lead to clean air and clean water and grows the beautiful trees and forests that we have that we like to be out and walking in nature. All of that is the soil. And if we had no soil, we would all be hungry, cold, and without a home, and we would also be naked. All of the things that we use, everything comes from the soil in some way.
Fascinating. Just about out of time. I want to take a couple more minutes and talk about family farming and the future. I keep reading alarming stories. And then as we go through tariffs and climate change and all of this, what a farmer is going through and having to borrow money and banks being reluctant to loan money now with the situation, situations the way they are. What's the future of family farming?
Well, it actually is, if we vote with our dollars, if we're at the let's go to a farmer's market and support the local farmer, the future of family farming is pretty rough. When you look out that our average age of a farmer across the United States is something in the like 64, 65 years old. There's not a lot of young coming in behind them. But even if someone that's young wants to farm, they can't afford the farmland because there's developers and individuals that are going through and
Yes.
buying the farmland up. And because of that, it leads to it nearly impossible to get into the farming. But then the cost of inputs are so expensive, it's really hard to compete. And when you're looking at the cost of food items, you go to a grocery store and some of these really inexpensive bits of food, although the cost has gone up, and that's because the cost of everything else, the inputs are going up. But it's not the farmer who generally gets all that money. There's an awful lot of middlemen in between from the farm until it gets to our plate. Sometimes they say there's as many as six to seven different people that have a piece of that pie. So there's, you divide that pie up a lot of ways, the slice that goes to the farmer is small. So if you buy directly from your farmer at a local farmer's market, stop by their stand, things of that nature, you can directly help ensure that the farmer gets the largest share of what it needs to be able to support. Because if we don't have those local family farmers that generally grow the actual fruits and vegetables
Yes.
and things that we eat, and not just corn and soybean and cotton, if we don't have those, we're going to be relying on food coming in from other countries, as it does right now in most grocery stores. I mean, if when you have a lettuce or a tomato in the middle of winter, it isn't coming from the United States.
It's somewhat alarming when you always check and you can find out that the origin of the particular piece of produce or fruit that you have there. It's like, okay, this is sort of amazing that all the way from there to here, and now I'm eating it. I'm always amazed when I see farm equipment and the price tag on that. Not only the cost of the land, what you've got maybe hundreds of thousands of dollars in different pieces of equipment that you need to work the land.
Yes, although I would say that the smaller holder farmer, your kind of more fruit vegetable type that maybe is growing at the farmer's market, they are often not investing in those big pieces of, they are trying to use as little mechanization as possible and working the soil less, which leads to a healthier soil.
Yes.
And so there is some benefit in the smaller farmer that's being able to do that. But when you're looking at the large acres, thousands of acres, yeah, those tractors can cost up to millions of dollars, and that equipment is very expensive. Well, the larger the farmer, they generally tend to have the ability to take advantage of insurance coverage. So if there is a crop failure, they do still get a payment. The bigger you are, it's they always say, like, go big or go home kind of thing. In farming, there is economy of scale for the larger farmer. For the smaller farmer, they don't have that necessarily that safety net. So there's a little bit of, it depends on which farming you are talking about. However, farming is hard no matter what type of farmer you are.
Yes.
And the most optimistic people in the world have to be farmers, because they continue to deal with all of the hardships year to year, with weather, crazy weather patterns, and you could have droughts and floods in the same year, but they go back out and they plant seed the next year.
Well, thankfully for all of us, they're persistent and they do that. Our guest, Dr. Yeah. Janelle Louise Oletz, O-H-L-E-T-Z. Website is simple, oletzgrow.com. The book is Between Farm and Fork. If readers walk away with just one lesson, let's break it down and not overwhelm them with too much. Break it down, one lesson from the conversation today, from the book Between Farm and Fork. What do you hope it is? What's the key, maybe number one to start?
Determine where you want to go by doing a little bit of self-reflection and finding out what you truly want to do, not what others think you should do. And then once you have that guidepost set in front of you, take one step forward at a time and continue to move forward, even if it's a half a step, and eventually you will get to where you want to go.
It's a remarkable story. The book is available wherever books are sold. It's also available in audiobook. The book is Between Farm and Fork, Journey to a True Path. The author, Dr. Janelle Louise Oletz, O-H-L-E-T-Z, website oletzgrow.com. Doctor, time will by too quickly. Excellent conversation. Thank you so much for joining us on the program.
Thank you very much for having me. Have a great day.
It is our pleasure. The program This Week in America. Website with all the information, thisweekinamerica.us. Check us out on YouTube, TWIATV. Enjoy the program and subscribe there as well.
You're listening to This Week in America with Rick Bratton. More after this.